Okay. I call tonight's talk Breaking Down the Walls of Heartache. I was reflecting recently on this scheme of things, the human realm, and it occurred to me that it is an extraordinarily difficult life to live, the human realm. We have these gross physical bodies that take gross physical impacts, and we experience physical pleasure and physical pain, and it's very gross. Yet we've also been blessed with very sensitive minds, subtle minds, that feel those blows very strongly. It's a life where we have to learn some pretty tough lessons at times. And we all of us experience heartache. The Buddha, after all, did say life is suffering. There's birth, because there's birth, there's aging, decay and death. There's grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain and despair. Times when we're united with the things we don't want and the things we want elude us. Times when we just cannot get what we want. It's no surprise then that all of us, all human beings, seek some kind of psychological protection, some kind of coping mechanism, some kind of defensive barrier to somehow parry the blows of life. Oh, I don't want to make this sound too too negative. Obviously, there are times when, you know, it's great. But we do. We all of us create masks. We create psychological barriers. Some barriers are somewhat aggressive. Some are very insular. We want to hide away from life. And in the Buddha's teaching also, there is this point that all unenlightened beings experience a very basic and fundamental separation, an invisible barrier that separates them from reality. And all these walls actually prevent proper communicating with beings and prevent proper communion with life. How are these walls built? Well, in one word, resistance. Whenever we resist the way life is, we create a wall. For instance, we've got married, got a couple of kids, and yet we've got a problem with commitment, and there's a resistance to being in that family situation. If we resist, then we create a barrier from our own family and from our environment. All of us, I'm sure, have experienced times where we've wanted to be somewhere else. We haven't wanted the responsibility or the commitment. As soon as we resist, we create a barrier. And when we create a barrier, as Jackie James once said, our world goes dark. Our inner world goes dark. The building of the wall begins very early. Somebody I met just yesterday was telling me that when he had his first child, he got a book on how to bring up a kid. And it said that between the ages of 1 and 3 years was the time when most of that child's conditioning would take place, a huge chunk. After all, children at that age are learning so much. And I think he said something along the lines of, after the first 3 years, he had a sigh of relief. I can't go too far wrong as a parent now. I had an occasion a few years ago when I was in a restaurant, and I overheard a father telling his one-year-old daughter who was misbehaving, "That's not good enough." And when she misbehaved again, he said, "That's not good enough." And when I reflected on it, it occurred to me that that's not good enough, which is indicating that the behaviour wasn't acceptable, could be misinterpreted so easily to say, "You're not good enough." And a small child can take it on board at a very young age, the conditioning, "I'm not good enough as I am." And that can haunt somebody for an entire lifetime. This conditioning process, when we come up against painful situations, we resist and we form views about the way the world is. So that child perhaps grows up with the idea that I'm not good enough. Now that is an assumption. Of course, she is good enough. But the influence of our parents especially, and what they say to us when we're very young, has a dramatic effect. We create views, therefore, based on the incidents that happen to us and the resistance that goes in at those times. We create views based on our assumptions, and we begin to interpret our lives according to the views. And so we form an inherent bias. I've got an example of this to try and put it across exactly what I mean. A meditator recently had remembered, because there was a conversation around this kind of area, that whenever a talk show host appeared on TV, he would huff, either turn off the telly or change channels immediately. It was only during conversation about early life conditioning that he remembered, for some strange reason, this kind of thing going on. And he remembered that when he was very young, his mother watched the same talk show host, or rather didn't watch the same talk show host. She huffed and turned off the TV and went and did something else. He had merely picked up somebody else's resistance and had assumed that the talk show host was no good. He'd never actually watched the programme, so how would he know? And so his actions and his attitudes were biased. There was a resistance there based on assumptions and a barrier between him, when, in that case, a TV show and a talk show host. So do you see what's happening? He made a subtle comparison. This is no good. There was a resistance. And in doing so, he created a barrier. Now, it might be a somewhat trivial example, but I'm sure we've all got examples of early life conditioning. Especially, most people here are parents, of course, so you're seeing the same operation from the other side with your children. Also, in addition, of course, acting out our resistances to life, creating a barrier based on our views, we perceive whatever's going on in terms of our views. So, a talk show host seen on TV is not only viewed, believed to be no good, he's actually seen to be no good. The perception reflects the view, and a certain amount of thinking around the subject simply reinforces the view. So our views, our perceptions, and our thinking reinforce that bias all the time. So, throughout our lives, unless we actually start observing all this sort of thing, we find that we keep on constantly rebuilding the walls that separate us from life. But good news, it's not always like that, of course. There are times when the barrier is almost non-existent. There are times when the barrier is completely non-existent. You can't completely seal off what lies beyond the wall. For instance, falling in love. What happens when somebody falls in love? I hope you've all had an opportunity to test this one out. When you fall in love, you stop making comparisons for the time being. It's like the barrier between you and the world. What was the world that was separate to you actually becomes the stage on which the romance occurs. It might be the pub, the cinema, the park, wherever. But whereas before it was something separate to you, during those wonderful times of being in love, it becomes the set for your romance to take place. And there are no comparisons about other people at those times. There's certainly no comparisons with your beloved. There's no comparison going on at all. Another example where the barrier isn't there, in the late 90s, there was an eclipse. I saw it in London on Wimbledon Common. No, I didn't see the eclipse. I saw lots of cloud and it went a bit dark. There was no eclipse, actually, but we gave it a good show. But the point being that everyone had the same focus of attention. It was quite interesting to observe, actually, that everyone at that time all had just the watching the eclipse in mind. There was a shared consciousness, if you like. And there was great camaraderie between people who would otherwise, it would be barriers up, especially in London, where it's so densely populated. In order to get a bit of psychological space, you have to cut away from your fellow beings. But in that instance, the barrier actually came down because there was a common interest. Okay, so we create these barriers throughout our lives which stop us from truly communicating, from feeling truly alive, from truly communing with the world around us. What will bring down the wall? What can we do, or what does Buddhism suggest that we can do to bring down the wall? First, what I thought I'd mention are the 5 points of mundane right view. If we straighten our view about things like our early life conditioning, the way we were brought up, things of that nature, it helps enormously to come to terms with our conditioning, eventually to accept our conditioning. Let me try to illustrate. I'll name the 5 points of mundane right view for you. Generosity benefits the giver. Actions have results. There are mother and father, and they are worthy of our respect. There are spontaneously arisen beings, meaning that there are other realms of existence other than the human realm. And there are teachers that know about these things and can advise us. The two main themes of these 5 points of mundane right view are those of action and result and rebirth. If you take on the view of rebirth and the view that your actions have results, what this says is that the life we have chosen, the life we have chosen to be born into, I said that wrong, we have chosen the life that we have been born into. Yeah? We have chosen through our past actions in previous lives what the sorts of things we want to work on in this hard, difficult, gross, but also very sensitive human life. The Buddhist view is that we are here to learn lessons. And that means that our conditioning is right for us. The early lessons of our life, the parents that we have, is not coincidence, is not bad luck. It's exactly what we need in order to grow, to learn, to understand what works and what doesn't work. That's what this human life is for. Now, if we can take that on board, it means that a lot of the resistances that we have are there for very good reasons. And we can begin to accept their existence. It's not going to solve the problem for us, but the barriers that we have with the world, the way we respond to the world, is not coincidental or bad luck or society's fault. It's actually what we need in order to grow. Interestingly, the Buddha mentions there are mother and father as a very important point of mundane right view. And it's interesting that how pivotal that is between having acted in the past that need to produce results and the kind of mother and father that we are, the kind of parents and the kind of family that we're born into. The Buddha maintained that even if you were to carry your mother and father on your shoulders for the entire remainder of your life on earth, still you would not repay the debt for having brought you into this human realm in order for you to learn your lessons. Parental relationships are not easy. I've always admired people that have these wonderful, open, brilliant relationships with their parents. I wonder how many people can truly say that they had that kind of relationship. parental relationships are very, very difficult. It's very easy to come away from those early years with certain resentments and a certain conditioning. It's like going home to going back to the parental home, aged 42, and you end up acting like you did when you were 17, because the same old conditioning comes up. Now, if you can see that it couldn't be different, and that we've actually chosen to work on these lessons, then it helps in accepting those kind of conditioned responses from arising. When they arise, it's easier to accept, knowing that this is part of our learning in this lifetime. I mention this to make the point that adjusting our views to align reality, from the Buddhist point of view, helps us to learn to accept our conditioning, not to fight against it. What else can we do to help bring down the wall? Ceasing from performing selfish actions that create barriers between beings. The Buddha gave prohibitions, essentially, that if you wanted to bring down the barriers between you and other people and open up communications better with other people, then there were five prohibitions that would help enormously. They are killing or harming living creatures, ceasing from killing and harming living creatures, ceasing from taking that which is not given, ceasing from all sexual misconduct, ceasing from all forms of wrong speech, and ceasing from the use of intoxicants. Taking just the taking that which is not given as an example, I was used to live in a flat with housemates. One of the housemates went on holiday, came back to find that all the coffee in the coffee jar, their coffee jar from their cupboard, had completely and mysteriously disappeared. And although it's only coffee, and indeed the flatmate who had generously helped themselves to it was actually remorseful and obviously went off and got another jar of coffee when they realised what had happened, it lent an atmosphere of suspicion to the house temporarily, but it created a barrier. You see, it can be quite subtle sometimes, but there was that air of suspicion which was, I can't really trust these people with my stuff. And so it just lent a slight attitude to everything. So if people keep by these training precepts, I shouldn't call them prohibition, I'd call them training precepts really, then you very much ensure that you're not creating barriers with the people around you, because you're not performing actions that lend itself to suspicion and a sense of separation. Having ceased from performing actions that create barriers, we can also undertake actions that break down barriers. Generosity is a very good example, and the Buddha himself used generosity benefiting the giver as a main mundane right view. And as an example of this, I'll tie it in with the mundane right view with the teacher as well. Some time ago, a report came out which said that children who teachers favoured, found favourable, I should say, did better in their classes than the students who the teacher didn't get on with. And I was very struck by that, because I thought everyone, in the old days, mother would give the child an apple to take to the teacher. And it just seemed like, how to win the teacher's favour? Well, give a gift. It benefits the child, because the teacher looks at the child favourably, and the student does better with their lessons. And of course, The Buddha also mentions that there are teachers who can teach us about things like mundane right view, how to break down barriers between beings. And it really does tie in beautifully. So if you hold the teacher in respect, if you break down the barrier with the teacher, then you do better as a student. What else can we do to break down barriers? Another thing we can do is use our thinking skillfully. I often talk about the fact that our views, our perceptions, and our thinking are all very closely linked. If we can change the way we think about life, then that will inevitably condition our views and our perceptions. So it must do something for the barriers which separate us. The practice of metta is using thinking skillfully, and it breaks down barriers. Alan was telling me recently of a student from a very long time ago who had great difficulties with members of her family. And with Alan's help, she began, I think she'd been estranged for 10 years or something like that. And with Alan's help, mentioning this kind of things, she put into policy, she had a policy of sending gifts to her estranged family members, to writing to them, and practicing lots and lots of metta to them. In the end, they all came together. The issues that they had were resolved. She got her family back after a very long time. And that's the power that using thinking skillfully can have. Also, something I thought I'd mention. We can temporarily suppress thinking by using concentration techniques. If you absorb the mind, watching the rise and fall of the breath, or in any particular object, thinking will subside. And when thinking subsides, all the comparisons that we make about life, this is better than that, I don't like that, I do like her, I don't like him, all that kind of thing, that subsides too. And what a meditator finds is there's this beautiful sense of unity arises, a sense of belonging. It's no wonder that concentration meditation is so addictive for people, because it really does give this wonderful sense of having broken the barriers that separates. And someone can be left for quite a while afterwards with a wonderful sense of really belonging in the world. It's a bit like falling in love temporarily. There's just no sense of separation. Communication is easy. You haven't got a problem with people. You understand people so much more easily. And it really is a very blissful, beautiful state to get into. And some people can mistake that for the cessation of suffering through understanding that we teach here, because it is so delightful. And it's not a criticism of it, because it is a wonderful thing to be able to do. And genuinely, for the time being, the barriers come down. But ultimately it's flawed, because it requires constant effort to keep it going. If circumstances change, as inevitably they do, you might not be in a position to be able to practice concentration meditation, and whoa, what a terrible thing, all the beautiful feelings of love and unity just disappear. It needs constant work to maintain it. There is another way to break down the barrier, and that is through insight wisdom, practicing vipassana, where with concentration what you do is you temporarily suppress all that thinking, all the comparison. The views don't get formed, the perceptions aren't there. It's a delightful state to be in. But imagine having to go and do the shopping while you're in that absorbed state. Nobody can shop and do jhana at the same time. it's not possible. Because when you shop, you have to use your thinking. You have to compare. You have to compare prices. Yeah? So you can't be in that state of unity because you have to use thinking. You have to use comparison. What we do with insight meditation is not suppress our thinking or our views or our or these comparisons. What we do is we break the attachment to them. And that's a fundamental difference. We break the attachment of saying, this is me, this is mine, this is myself. As an example, there was a meditator who, on retreat, a memory came up of having been thoroughly teased by his siblings in such a way that it left a really deep resentment in him. And he had managed to pretty much suppress that resentment for all those years, but it was always kind of under the surface. It was some terrible teasing. It was nothing more than teasing, but he took it too seriously. Anyway, during a particular meditation, this memory arose hugely in his mind, with an awful lot of attachment, of course. And he blubbed, he cried. It was terrible, terrible for him. He really felt it had ruined a part of his life. Eventually, he went to see his teacher, and his teacher, being a sage, listened very carefully to what he had to say, helped wipe away the tears. And when the meditator had pulled themselves together, he said, you know, the only thing you've forgotten here is, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. And the meditator got it. He understood. It was like suddenly like a burden had been lifted. He saw that he had identified with it as my problem for 20 years? No, more than that. 25 years? A quarter of a century? He had held on to that resentment. He had done sufficient work to recognize a very simple process that all minds undergo. There is some kind of sensory contact, there is a feeling, and there is a response, a conditioned response to the feeling. A memory arose of having been teased when he was 8 years old or something. A painful feeling arose, and he reacted with resentment. There was just a process: contact, painful feeling, resentment. It wasn't him. Not only that, all those factors simply had the nature to arise and pass away. He saw that. He saw it wasn't him. It wasn't something. There was no. He saw that that was a past event. It had no reality. The problem was that he had an attachment to it. But when he saw with insight that all those factors were transient, unsatisfactory, meaning nothing to grasp onto, and were anatta, non-self, he just let go. And in that moment, the resentments to his siblings completely vanished. Now, a little bit later, he had another memory pop up of that same incident. There was a painful feeling, and he thought, you rotters, how could you do that to me? The same process, the whole of the same process, but the difference was, this time he saw, quite simply, that there was nothing to do. As a result, his relationship with his siblings improved, because he no longer blamed them. He no longer held an underlying view that there was a problem. Now, I make it sound all crystal, sort of, you just have to see it once and there you go. But actually, you have to do a lot of hard work, a lot of insight work. But essentially, That is what we practice insight meditation to do. We're not trying to get rid of thinking. We're not trying to get rid of our views as such. All we're trying to get rid of is the belief that, or I put it another way, that it is the attachment to them that is the problem. Because they are all non-self. It's like defusing a bomb. As soon as you see that it's not self, it's like all its power is taken away. You can't stop the conditioned response from occurring. But when you take away the attachment, there is a perfect acceptance of that process. So you no longer have to do anything with it. It just arises and passes away. So what I'm trying to say is, it's like instead of sort of interpreting everything for you from via your view structure, like here, and so there always being a bias, it's like the view structure falls down here, and you see life without the barrier of your views and your assumptions, but it's like you're still aware that the process goes on, and you can either choose to see it in that way or see it in a completely different way. There's a complete acceptance, and there's absolutely no harm. I hope that makes sense. I'd just like to review what I've tried to say tonight. We all experience heartache. Life is suffering. And it is inevitable that we form psychological protections and defensive barriers. Those walls actually prevent total communion with life. What creates the wall is resisting the way life is. Much of that resistance comes from early life conditioning, but that conditioning actually passes back into previous lives. We form assumptions about the way life is, which are clung to and which we do not challenge. And that wall is being constantly rebuilt. The keys to bringing down the wall: straighten our views, cease from performing selfish actions that create barriers, undertake actions that break barriers down, use thinking skillfully, bring a sense of unity through temporary suppression of thinking, but most importantly, break the attachment to the conditioned views, perceptions and thoughts, rather than try to get rid of them. See their impermanent and conditioned arising. And when you see it perfectly, you're free from it. It's no longer a problem. There is, of course, the difficulty of this apparently impenetrable barrier between the unenlightened mind and the enlightened mind, which really you're all here because you want to solve this conundrum. It comes a point when everyone has to face that last comparison, the enlightened mind and the unenlightened mind. Imagine a teacher talking to a student about reality. An enlightened teacher talking to an unenlightened student about reality. And he or she is just talking about reality. And the unenlightened student goes, "Oh, it must be wonderful. Oh, how I wish I would like to be in that situation." And the teacher's going, "But you are in that situation. That is how it is." To the enlightened teacher, there's absolutely no separation. There's no barrier. There's no difference between enlightenment and unenlightenment in that sense. But the student doesn't believe him or her. The student thinks there is a real difference. They see themselves as being unenlightened and the teacher as being enlightened. But imagine if somebody else, a third person who had never meditated, never listened to a Buddhist talking in their life, didn't know anything about the two individuals, walked in on that conversation, would they see an enlightened being and an unenlightened being? No, they wouldn't. Their perception would not be like that at all. It only resides in the mind of the unenlightened student. It's a comparison. And what the student has to do is simply see that it is a comparison. But of course it doesn't work like that. You have to do all the preparatory work. But it's when the student realises that actually they've done the work and that that comparison between enlightened and unenlightened is just yet another view, another perception, another thought. It goes from being here and it just goes to there. Instead of interpreting through that view, it simply becomes another thought, anatta, another view, anatta, another perception, anatta. And the mind goes incredibly quiet, even though there's thinking, even though there may be an opinion, even though there may be a comparison. But the mind is supremely quiet because there is no attachment. And one of the nicest illustrations I've heard is like passing through a door in a wall that you've been trying to get through for so long. And you pass through the door in the wall to a completely new universe, and you turn around and find there was never a wall there. And when somebody does walk through, then that wall of separation, that wall of heartache, can never be built again because it was founded on ignorance, which is gone. And there is a true understanding of what non-separateness really means. And there is total communion with the immensity of all that is.